Our first reading this morning comes from the Reverend Victoria Safford, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church in White Bear, Minnesota. Here is a meditation of hers on the comings and goings of life titled In Between.
One afternoon, some time ago, I brought my little baby out to visit a very, very old neighbor who was dying that year, quietly and gracefully in her home. We were having a little birthday party for her with sherry and cake. A few friends gathered around her bed. To free a hand to cut the cake, I put my baby down right on the bed, right up on the pillow. And there was a sudden hush in the room, for we were caught off guard, beholding. It was a startling sight. There in the late afternoon light were two people, side by side. Neither could speak, both utterly dependent on the rest of us, who were bustling around masquerading as immortals. There they were. A plump one, apple-cheeked, a cherry tomato of a babe, smiling, and a silver-thin one, hollow-eyed, translucent, shining, smiling. We revelers were hustling and hushed because we clearly saw that these were dancers on the very edge of things. These two were closer to the threshold, the edge of the great mystery, than any of us had been for a long time, or would be for a while thereafter, living, breathing, smiling they were, but each with one foot, and who knows how much consciousness, firmly planted on one side, the other side, whatever that is. The starry darkness from whence we come, and whither we will go in time. Fresh from birth, nigh unto death, bright-eyed, they were bookends there. Mirrors of each other, radiant.
Our second reading this morning comes from Remembering, a short novel by Wendell Berry. The story concerns a man named Andy, who was a farmer in Kansas until he lost a hand in a farming accident. At the time of the novel, he is working in agribusiness, and in our passage, he is flying home to Kansas from a work conference in San Francisco.
To Andy, The air is an element as dangerous to mind as body. For wingless creatures, it is the element of abstract distance and speed, abstract desire. Flight seems to him to involve some radical disassemblement, as if one may pass through it only as a loose suspension of particles threatened with dispersal. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain speaking. We want to welcome you aboard and thank you for flying with us. We're ascending now to our cruising altitude of 37,000 feet. Our route today will carry us approximately over Denver, Springfield, Illinois, Indianapolis, and then down to Cincinnati. As soon as we have reached altitude, our cabin attendants will be around with complimentary beverages. So settle back, folks, and enjoy your flight. 37,000 feet is over 7 miles. How long would it take to fall 7 miles? He thinks of falling 7 miles and knowing that one is falling. Flight has always returned him to the ancient desire to be at home. He does not want to die in some place of abstraction or in a featureless heap in some place he has never seen, but he fears most his body's brutal fear of falling, or falling through the high and alien air and knowing it. His hand, that had imagined many things, had never imagined its own absence. He wonders, if they were going down, would the woman sitting beside him be willing to hold his hand? He looks at her covertly, wondering. Holding hands, they would go down through the miles of air and crash into their absence from the earth forever. She catches him looking, lifts her chin a little, and tugs down the hem of her skirt. Now you've done it, he thinks. You'll have to crash by yourself.
Thank you, Nathan. As we begin this week of discernment and looking ahead, I want to begin by offering a more pastoral talk. I'll follow this up with an outward reflection next Sunday. I don't know just how it happened, but records show that I began professional ministry over 12 years ago now. I was looking back at the candidating materials I put together then and experienced a deep sense of unbelief. Maybe some of you have at one point or another felt something similar. I couldn't believe I was ever so young. And yet in the first months of my ministry, I encountered something that surprised me. I discovered there was something I knew that a good number of folks senior to me in the congregation had not yet experienced. A sense of going through, having lived through deep grief. I had lost my father several years before. I knew something about loss and what grief can put a person through. But due to medical advances and having some means, I was encountering people 10, 20 years older than me that had not yet experienced a major loss in their lives. At first, I thought they were lucky. And then I began to think again. When you are nearing 50, with a teenage daughter and your wife dies unexpectedly, that loss is more than enough. But if you've never lost someone close to you before, the surprise of what grief can do to a person adds insult to injury. That was one case. There were many others. These were people who thought they knew themselves, and they did, but not as fully as they would come to. What's the saying? You can't know what you don't know. So when I found the following passage, I used it in almost every memorial service I conducted. This is Helen Keller from her book, We Bereaved, published in 1929. We bereaved are not alone. We belong to the largest company in all the world, the company of those who have known suffering. When it seems that our sorrow is too great to be borne, let us think of the great family of the heavy-hearted into which our grief has given us entrance, and inevitably we will feel about us their arms, their sympathy, their understanding. She continues, believe when you are most unhappy that there is something for you to do in the world. For so long as you can sweeten another's pain, life is not in vain. We have some funny notions about what is normal in our society. I wanted to make room in what was considered normal for coping with sorrow and loss, of finding your world turned upside down, your sense of self emptied out, and the effort it can make to rise again out of the ashes. While we pray that this will not be an everyday experience, it is something that all of us who approach life with open hearts will face. It is normal. And while we may feel utterly alone when we are grieving most deeply, all of us will come to know that anguish, so we are really only as alone as we allow ourselves to become. There is an often told Zen story of a woman whose child has died. She is bereft. She is inconsolable, as you might imagine. In her grief, she sought out the Zen master in the village and asked for what he could do to lift the burden from her heart. And this he agreed to do. But first she had to go to every household in the village and find one home that had not been struck by tragedy. Off she went, door to door, street to street, Each family she encountered had endured heartbreak. She returned to the Zen master, both humbled and grateful. Her suffering had not been lifted from her. Instead, when she realized the burdens that others were also carrying, it was as if a veil had been lifted from in front of her. Her pain was not eased, but her compassion grew when she realized that others knew sorrow as deep as her own. She realized now that she belonged to the largest community in the world, the company of those who have known suffering. Each of us will grieve in our own way. Some wail openly. Some will walk through their pain quietly by themselves. The ways in which we move through Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, vary from person to person. And the same person may experience more depression with one loss and then find him or herself bargaining more during another. And I'm also sure that these stages are culturally bound. When I see pictures of women in the Middle East, for example, wailing over the loss of a son and daughter, I don't see denial or acceptance. I just see fully embodied anguish. Over the years, I've gone back countless times to some advice my supervising minister was given shortly after he learned the seriousness of the cancer which would ultimately take his life. Keep a large field before you in your imagination, he was told. In it, you will find horses. These are your emotions. Give them all the room to wander and run that they need. Or, as Anne Lamott puts it, grief, as I read somewhere once, is a lazy Susan. One day it is heavy and underwater, and the next day it spins and stops at loud and rageful, and the next day at wounded keening, and the next day numbness and silence. While there are many ways to grieve well, my comments this morning have been inspired by those of you who have been in the congregation's grief group I've helped lead. We call the group the Healing Journey. Many, but not all of those in the groups have taken part after the death of a loved one. Others have come due to other losses in their lives. Those who join in the groups come together in their grief and share tears. They also laugh together. Again and again, I've been reminded of the title of one of Alice Walker's books, The Way Forward is with a Broken Heart. It just is. One of the things I love most about ministry is that it helps me keep my own priorities clearly before me. As Harold Kushner writes, only when we learn to see the fate of the aging and dying as our fate, as well as theirs, will we be able to share their last adventure with them and learn from them how to live out our days. Yet aging and mortality are not the only causes of grief I want to talk with you about this morning. There are also the things we do to one another. In the Wendell Berry piece Mark read earlier, we know how scared Andy is of flying, but the woman he sits next to doesn't. How many times would she have noticed men giving her the once-over, either looking with approval or being judged as unworthy of the gift of their attention? If what transpires between the two characters rings true for us, it is because that sort of thing happens every day. We miss connection because we fail to rise out of a background in which trust is too often broken, too often betrayed. Andy didn't share his fear with the woman. He didn't let her know what was on his mind, why he was looking at her. Would she have responded differently if he had? Who knows? What I do know is that the feeling of being alone, the fear of being and dying alone, is one we share. We know what it feels like not to be surrounded by the arms, sympathy, and understanding of others when we need them the most. How much more so when someone is violently taken from us? Some of you may have read the article in the current UU World magazine about the Pennsylvania poet Kathleen Sheeter Bonanno. When her 21-year-old daughter, Lady, was murdered in 2003, Kathleen turned to her writing to help her move through her grief. Of note for us today is the following poem about the aftermath of the trial, which found Joseph Eady guilty of Lady's murder and sentenced him to life in prison without parole. And note that in this poem, Bonanno uses the name Johnny Early for Joseph Eady. Here is her poem, Church of Justice. Guilty, say the jurors. We gasp and sigh and hug and weep, just like on TV. We walk down the aisle, and a woman waits in the hallway for me. She says my name. I have studied her, Johnny Early's mother, and despise her and the son she carried. She says, I am so sorry. Suddenly, she is tiny. She has a tooth missing from the bottom row. She holds out her arms, and what can I do? What? But hold her back, but hug her back. My truest other sister. She says, I am so sorry. My truest other sister. In recognizing the other mother's suffering, Bonanno realized the connection between the two. They may never encounter each other again, but the experience forged a bond between them. Both of them have had their lives recast by an act of senseless violence. Bonanno could have walked on by the other woman, but she didn't. She embraced her instead. Even if she only did this in the poem and not in real life, it doesn't matter. She still opened herself to the other woman's humility and her need. I recommend her collection of poems, Slamming Open the Door, to you. Slamming open the door. That's what grief does to us. It slams open the door to our soul. When I was in high school, I remember a girl named Pam. We shared the very beginnings of a friendship. Perhaps it might have become a romance. She had transferred in during our junior year. She was quiet, but we would talk together. Then one day she told me a story I didn't know what to do with. The details of the story are sketchy at this point, years later, but if memory serves, her mother had had an affair, and her mother's boyfriend had talked to someone he knew about killing the husband, Pam's mother. I don't think the plan was carried out, but there had been a trial. Her mother and her mother's boyfriend were found guilty and were in jail, as Pam told me the story. I had never encountered something like that before. It wasn't that I didn't believe her. I simply couldn't fathom something like that happening in the life of the person sitting next to me. I couldn't wrap my head around it, let alone figure out how to respond. And that lack on my part severed what might have been a great friendship. Pam didn't return to school the next year. If I were working the 12 steps, I'd seek Pam out now to make amends. I was young then, but I'd want her to know that I've learned by that mistake, and maybe someday I will. I remember back in California, a woman I counseled going through a troubled marriage, and on Christmas one day, her leaving her husband with her children. That husband came back and interrupted our services on consecutive Sundays after that. And it was after that experience that I went to work with the women's shelter in town and ended up serving on their board for a time. I've certainly been surprised by what has come my way, both in ministry and the rest of my life, but I've never been caught so completely off guard as I was that day, Pam told me her story. In the reading from Victoria Stafford earlier, she talks about how many of us bustle around, masquerading as immortals. Many of us also masquerade behind a veil of innocence. The thing is, the true community isn't possible when we try to deny the painful aspects of life. When we can open ourselves to sadness, or as I often describe it, to allow grief to move through us, it does have a will of its own, then we have a better chance of learning what's possible as we move through. As Forrest Church said, we cannot protect love from death, but by giving away our hearts, but by giving away our hearts, we can protect our lives from the death of love. Kathleen Bonanno chose to give away a bit of her heart to the mother of the man who killed her daughter. In doing so, she found the world that much larger. She realized that both she and the other mother belonged to the community of those who have known suffering. She could have passed by the woman. No one would have faulted her if she had. Instead, she accepted what she saw as an authentic expression of regret and found in that moment not rage, but a sister in grief. Is it such a difficult thing when we look at those around us, whether that be here in this room, at work, or as we wait in line at the grocery store, to imagine not just the housewife or accountant, not just the young Turk wannabe or the panhandler, but the person who has lost a sister, a father, a wife, and has still risen to reach out anew? If we can, when we do, chances are that we'll be that much more willing to reach out and take that offered embrace when the next fall comes. Thank you.